This October, the most important week in bluegrass returns to Chattanooga, Tennessee. Be part of IBMA World of Bluegrass October 20th through the 24th for 5 unforgettable days of live music, networking, and family fun. Join thousands of bluegrass artists and fans for the IBMA Business Conference, IBMA Bluegrass Ramble, IBMA Bluegrass Music Awards, and IBMA Bluegrass Live Festival. Get your tickets, see the lineup, and start planning your week at worldofbluegrass.org. Thanks for listening to the BGS Podcast Network. If you're interested in diving deeper into the world of roots music, Americana, and beyond, be sure to explore more from The Bluegrass Situation. Visit thebluegrasssituation.com to browse the latest editorials. And don't forget to subscribe to our weekly newsletter for new releases, exclusive content, video sessions, and more delivered straight to your inbox. Sign up at thebluegrasssituation.com/newsletter.
They say there's nothing new under the sun, and ain't that the truth? The Working Songwriter has been on the air for over 10 years and 300 episodes now. As you've probably noticed, only the latest 100 published episodes are available in your podcast app and on Spotify. So, we're bringing back some of the gems from past years. Of course, if you want access to every single episode of the show at any time, you can become a subscriber to The Vault. What is The Vault? The Vault is a private, members-only section of my website, joepugmusic.com, where you can access any episode of the show for streaming and for download. In the meantime, we're bringing back some classic episodes to the main feed. Is that a reason to not join The Vault? Of course not, because it means that our latest episodes will only get paywalled all the sooner. Is this a relatively convoluted system? Of course it is, but such are the trade-offs that the ever-changing media landscape leaves us to navigate. Thank you for being here. It's always an honor that you listen to the show, and I hope you enjoy some of these classic episodes. Today's episode with Frank Turner was originally aired on April 8th, 2022. I hope that you enjoy this classic episode. Week began his career as the vocalist for the post-hardcore band Million Dead, before stepping out on his own to begin a wildly successful solo career. Frank Turner hails from the UK, but his following stretches the world over. He's released 9 albums, selling well over 1 million copies, and his latest release has hit #1 in England. He's recorded for Epitaph, Polydor, and Interscope Records. He's toured with The Offspring, Jason Isbell, Chuck Reagan's Revival Tour, and many others. He's headlined Royal Albert Hall and Wembley Arena. NME has called him a slow burn success story, and American Songwriter has said that he's a decidedly engaged artist, a musician who's far more than just a brash provocateur. In truth, it would be hard to find a punk with greater purpose. I got a chance to catch up with Frank on the phone a few weeks back and hear about his journey so far. Frank Turner, thanks so much for being a part of the Working Songwriter Podcast. I got to tell you, getting ready for this interview, it seems like to me that you've lived and worked like 5 different careers in the span of 20 years. So it's going to be hard to get this all in. It might not be wise to start at the beginning because that could stop us from getting it all in. But nonetheless, I'd like to start there. What did music and creativity look like in your household growing up?
That's a good question. I mean, music looked like my parents when I was very young. My parents don't really believe in modern music. Like the drum kit is kind of beyond their remit. So my parents listened to classical music and church music and that kind of thing. I do remember that we had my mum got a copy of Sgt. Pepper on cassette as here's some modern music, which is like wow. And there was some kind of old kind of like music hall vaudeville stuff. There's a little bits of that around too, but rock and roll in the broadest sense of the term wasn't really part of it. I mean, my mum taught piano and recorder at the local kind of primary school and stuff. So, you know, there was music around, but it wasn't punk rock and it wasn't rock music and or anything like that. And I mean, creativity, I don't know. Like, it's not, it wasn't like not encouraged or anything like that, but I don't really. Neither of my parents are especially like creators, should we say. So my first real exposure was when I stumbled across the music of Iron Maiden when I was about 10 years old, and that was a huge light bulb moment for me in my musical development.
Man, that's a trip. So many of the people I rap with on this show, the story seems to go, well, I got a hold of my parents' record collection, and it was filled with all these, you know, great rock and roll stuff, great, yeah, you know, folk heroes. And yet, you're coming from a place where you say, you know, maybe it wasn't discouraged, but at the same time, you really had to seek it out yourself. What do you think it was that made you seek it out in that sense, and why didn't you just end up a banker or something like that?
Well, I think my parents would have preferred that. And it's funny, there was some discouragement that comes later in the story because my first loves were metal and punk rock, and this was completely foreign to my parents, and I bought a copy of a music magazine that had a feature on Cannibal Corpse in it, and my mum then banned me from buying music magazines. Incidentally, I still love Cannibal Corpse. I think they're amazing, but yeah. That's a whole other thing. But, you know, so I guess, like, I was just, there's a purity to it to me. There was something just so exciting when I heard the song Ides of March, which is track one on the album Killers by Iron Maiden, and just the drums and the guitars and everything, it was so exciting to me. But also, you know, relevant to all of this is there was a sense of ownership for it for me. You know, it wasn't something that was kind of given to me or I was encouraged towards. I've long felt like, maybe not in my adulthood, but certainly all through my childhood and adolescence, any interest I had in music was something I had to actively fight for and actively seek out myself. And it means it's kind of mine, you know, and I'm fiercely sort of protective of it as a result. And, you know, over time, that interest broadened from metal into punk into just kind of rock and roll and even folk music and country and all the rest of it. But it's my thing that I had to seek out and find. And I think that that's a big part of how I think about music, is it's very dear to me.
It's funny. Yeah, I can actually draw a straight line between that and, you know, you have this... You've always had a career where you very famously have kind of just, like, done what you've wanted to do. The business of it be damned, and that's interesting in a way. That's kind of an advantage.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's, you know, with no disrespect to anybody, but like I have dear friends who were, you know, raised by very musical parents who are very supportive and who like took them to Glastonbury when they were five and all this kind of thing. And that's cool and that's great, but it's so alien to me. You know, I had to sneak out of the house to go to shows. I had to kind of lie to my parents when I went to my first music festival, all this kind of thing, you know. So, and there is a sense of ownership that comes with that, and a dedication. You know, I feel like music's always had me, and I'm always going to have music. Like, I think of the song Radio by Rancid, which is one of my all-time favorite songs, and he sings the line, you know, when I've got the music, I've got a place to go. And that's always been one of the ways I think about music in the broadest sense, is it's kind of a refuge for me.
In fairness to your mom, it wasn't a magazine about the Ramones you brought home. It was Cannibal Corpse. So you got to kind of
absolutely. You know, although I mean, I'm not sure. My mom, I think, was under the impression that kind of rock and roll shows involved kind of bikers injecting each other with heroin in the dark. And of course, she wasn't wrong. No, I'm kidding. But you know, as an adult, in fairness to my parents, now I sort of recognize that what I was involved in was just completely alien to their experience of the world. They didn't know anything about any of this music. My dad was 18 in the Summer of Love, and I was the one who told him who Jimi Hendrix was. You know, it was just not their world. And I can understand now, with a few more years under my belt, that it could be quite sort of alarming almost for your child to kind of, particularly at quite a young age, to immerse themselves in this world. And then, of course, punk rock, which comes with more than just the music. There's, you know, haircuts and bondage trousers and brothel creepers and the rest, but also getting into kind of like anarchism and this sort of thing. And it was quite all-consuming for me as a kid.
So when did this go from something that you were listening to and kind of participating in passively or just as an audience member to something that you were going to start making yourself?
Well, I mean, theoretically, immediately, in the sense that I remember hearing Iron Maiden, and actually shortly afterwards, a big thing for me was the Freddie Mercury tribute concert was on TV in the UK, and that had, like, you know, Metallica and Guns N' Roses, obviously lots of Queen, Sabbath, members of Zeppelin, all this kind of thing. And almost from the word go, and I think this is a deeper-seated thing in my character anyway, I was like, I want to do that. I want to be involved. I want to be part of this. And obviously at the beginning, that was a statement made with very little kind of realistic appraisal of what that might involve, you know. But I got the electric guitar starter pack from a catalogue store thanks to my parents, and, you know, good for them for that. And it's like, you know, it was like $80 and you get a black and white Strat copy and a 30 watt amp and a strap and a lead and a pick and a Burt Whedon playing a day book and all this kind of thing. And you know, and I started trying to learn Megadeth riffs, which I still don't really know how to play because they're hard. And Nirvana was a huge deal for me on so many different levels, but one of them was I could actually play those songs, you know. And that was quite revelatory to me. But yeah, I mean, right from the beginning, it was like, how do I do this? I want to be part of this. The degree to which that was kind of real world practical or realistic or whatever has changed over time. You know, when I was kind of 12, I wanted to be an Iron Maiden and be a rock star and have long hair and tattoos and all the rest of it. And then when I was in my mid-teens, I was very into the whole kind of super anarchistic DIY crime think, like screw venues and record labels forever sort of thing. You know, swinging wildly all over the map as I've been wont to do in my life. And then there's a point in my life where it started becoming a more realistic thing and understanding the industry and understanding, you know, how to make a band kind of get legs or a solo career or whatever it might be. But the desire to participate was immediate.
But you chose artists throughout that whole thing that were very kind of DIY and participatory, even the metal end of it. I mean, Iron Maiden, very famously, they fly their own, they're the pilots of their own jet, right, to go around
the
world.
Yeah, sure. So that, well, and they had a beautiful DIY moment at the beginning of their career with the Soundhouse tapes and all that kind of thing. And there's, you know, punk rock arrived in my life, and what was so wonderful about it then and now to me is that the requirement for entry in punk rock is showing up. And enthusiasm, do you know what I mean? If you're there and you want to be there and you want to be part of it, then you are part of it. And my journey into the world of punk rock took place at roughly the same time that the Britpop thing was blowing up in the UK, which I always loathed and felt very alienated by, because it was a scene that was predicated on cool and on irony and on those kinds of things. And I hated that because I'd never been cool, and I maintain that I still never have been cool, and I don't want to be cool. I don't want to be invited to after parties, do you know what I mean? Like, and with punk rock, it was like, if you found out where it was and you wanted to be there and you liked the music, then you were in. That was it. That's all you needed. You needed to care. And I thought that was a beautiful thing, and I still do, you know. And it remains very dear to me.
We're going to get a little bit ahead of ourselves here, but I do want to ask, you know, pursuant to that point there, how do you maintain that sort of given that the barrier to entry is just showing up and being enthusiastic with kind of punk, how do you maintain that over the course of 20 years? You've been in it for a long time, and you still kind of have this this kind of beginner's energy to you when you talk about it. I didn't mean that in any sort of
No.
I think you I'll know the spirit in which I meant that.
I'll take that as a compliment.
So, but how do you keep that sort of fire specifically kindled?
I mean, I don't know. That's a good question. And I mean, I suppose I would also say that there are days when I don't, good Lord, you know. And I think, like anybody who got kind of, who lost themselves to punk rock as a concept at any point, it's quite a lot like Catholicism, by which I mean that, like, you'll never be a non-punk. You might be an ex-punk, you might be a lapsed punk, but you still think about what Ian MacKay would have to say about your decisions when you're lying awake in bed at night or whatever, you know. And there's definitely been days and periods of my life where the reality of a punk scene has been quite disappointing to me or quite alienating. But to a degree, what I do now isn't really part of, quote-unquote, the punk scene. It's kind of established a thing unto itself. And one of my dearest friends once said to me, he said, oh, I see what you're doing. You're trying to build a version of the punk scene as you thought it was when you were 15. And you're trying to recreate that. And I said, yeah, that's a fair cop, you know. But I guess just ultimately I'm blessed by the fact that I'm still kind of as fired up by a good song and by good music and a good show as I ever was, you know. I mean, there's levels in which you're never going to be quite as blown away by things as you were when you were 16, you know what I mean? But nevertheless, like, just seeing a great band kill it, or a great singer play a song that I wasn't expecting, that still fires me up as much as anything else. And actually, this is majorly jumping ahead, but one of my more recent things is I've started producing for other artists, and it's just the greatest thing, because you work with younger artists. I'm 40 years old now, and I've been working with artists who are 20 years younger than me, and they're full of piss and vinegar, and it's the first time they've ever been in a studio. And you say something which to me is so mundane, like, hey, why don't we double track that guitar? And they go, wow, you know, or whatever. And there's this wonderful kind of... if I ever feel jaded, which I do, or bored, or whatever, engaging with younger bands is the exciting thing to do for me. Go to a new band night. Go and see some kids who are doing it for the first time, and they'll blow you away.
So that's what you're kind of getting from them. What do you think that you're imparting to them? What are they learning from you?
Well, I mean, I've spent a lot of my time... and the majority of my life kind of in and around studios and thinking about songs and songwriting and particularly arrangements and that kind of thing. And, you know, the process of learning to be a producer, I did a lot of kind of learning about the technicalities of how to operate a compressor or whatever. But actually, I realized that an awful lot of it was stuff that, to my surprise, was a skill set I already had, which is just kind of knowing that, like, hey, we need to lift that melody in that chorus, or, you know, maybe we should change the key in the bridge, or maybe we should cut that third verse, or, you know, and just that holistic thinking about the song as an entity. And I mean, you know, one of the things I feel very strongly about is, the older that I get, that I consider my interest to be songwriting, not without any genre qualifications. And I think that you can have that conversation about a Cannibal Corpse song the same as you can about a George Jones song, actually, with different kind of specifics, of course. but you know, and it's like just sort of allowing the song to win, allowing the song to breathe and to grow and to go where it wants to go and that kind of thing. And it's it turns out that my many years of slogging away at this has kind of given me, at the very least, a head start on, like, some kids coming into a studio. But as I was saying, like, the most interesting part of it to me is when it becomes a two-way street and they're teaching me things as well.
Yes.
You know, and pulling me out of my grooves and my my habits, should we say.
So from those many years, as you said, of slogging through it and with writing songs, how do you think your songwriting has changed the most over the last 20 years? Like, what have you learned from writing songs that you didn't know when you were 20 years old?
Many things. I mean, that's a huge question, and I like it. I think that, I mean, the first thing I'd say is I'd like to think I've got better at the craft side of songwriting. You bloody hope so, after that much time kind of slogging away at it. But as I'm sure we both understand, there's an art and a craft to songwriting, and they're sort of separate things in a way. And, you know, at this point in my life, I feel that when I come to write songs now, I'm much better at the craft side of it than I was when I was younger. The art side remains ephemeral. It remains ineluctable in its way. And also, you know, I find myself in a place where, like, quite often I feel like the low-hanging fruit has already been picked in terms of my subject matter choice. Do you know what I mean? I've written my breakup song, and I've written my touring song, and I've written my home song. And everybody can write those songs, but to find the subject matter or the feeling or the initial spark might take longer, but once that kind of that ball is rolling, I find it easier to direct it into a better place or a more interesting place or whatever it might be, you know. But in terms of what I learned about myself, I mean, there's a huge degree to which, for me, and I think for a lot of people, songwriting is a form of kind of catharsis or public therapy, or however you want to put it. And because I've been doing it for so long, it's almost like it's flipped, it's inverted, and I often figure out what I think about something in the process of writing about it, you know, particularly kind of emotionally significant events in my life. I'm not sure I learned things about, like, you know, gardening from writing songs, but, like, in terms of how to deal with relationships in my life or losses or whatever it might be, quite often the process of writing is the process of figuring out what I think about it and learning about myself and my reactions to it.
I love that idea of early on having the low-hanging fruit songwriting, and I feel like I think about you in the studio with those younger musicians, and you're getting to help them, whether they know it or not, you know, silently, you're kind of like, listen, man, this is your low-hanging fruit. Let's make it as good as we possibly can, because once the low-hanging fruit is picked, there's only medium to high-hanging fruit left, man.
Yeah, right, right. And like, and then that possibly that's the moment when... I'm trying to find an appropriate metaphor that sorts the wheat from the chaff to a degree, because everybody can reach the low-hanging fruit. And, you know, you talk about Dylan or whatever, and like, to me, Dylan becomes more interesting as a songwriter after his sort of first five records, because he's already used up his low-hanging fruit. He can't write, Don't Think Twice Again.
No, he can't. But what's so interesting, I feel the same way that you do, but what's so interesting with that is when I was younger, when I was his age, when he wrote that first crop of songs, I used to think to myself, these older albums of Bob Dylan's are the worst. I can't stand this stuff. These first five albums is where it's at. Then as I get older, I think I've listened to the song When He Returns, you know, probably 1,000 times in the last 5 years. You wouldn't have caught me dead listening to that song 10 years ago. You just wouldn't have. So
yeah.
Kind of the audience, in a way, has to go along with the journey as well, in the writer in that case.
Absolutely. But then it's funny you should mention that, because in a different field, like I'm a huge fan of the poetry of T.S. Eliot. And I found an interesting thing for me when I was younger, his younger work spoke to me. The Love Song of J.F. from Proof Rock and The Wasteland and the Preludes and all that kind of thing. And I couldn't really get my head around like Ash Wednesday and the quartets and that kind of thing. And as I get older, that later period stuff starts speaking to me more. And like, I think it's okay for different types of art to speak to different demographics, or different periods in a writer's career to speak differently to different topics, you know? And in a way, actually, maybe it should. And I spend a lot of my life at the moment thinking about writers who've had long careers, you know, as writers and who've maintained an interest. And for me, I think a lot about Nick Cave, and I think a lot about people like that. And they're sort of maintaining interest and maintaining originality and freshness over that period of time. Because I'm now at a point in my career where I have to do that. I have to justify writing another record, you know, because we're up to the high-hanging fruit now.
Okay, well, I said we were jumping ahead. Let's jump back for a second.
Sure.
The first group that put you on the map was called Million Dead. What was your creative role in that project? How did you get into it, and what did you learn from it?
I got into it. I was in another band before with some friends at school called Knee Jerk, and we were terrible. And that band broke up, and the drummer was started a new thing with some other people, and then I got sort of drafted in as the singer. We were kind of radically democratic band in a way that was, I think, a really good learning experience, and I think it made us better than we would otherwise have been, but it also doomed us to not last very long as a band, because the tensions that came along with that were pretty insurmountable over time. But, you know, nevertheless, like, I wrote a fair amount of the guitarist for that band, but like nothing that anybody wrote would survive intact. Do you know what I mean? Everybody attacked it from different angles and brought different things to it. In terms of the music, in terms of the vocals and particularly the lyrics, that was kind of my department. I mean, to the extent I have memories of, like, the other guys in the band didn't really care what I was doing over the top. Like, it was like, you know, we don't have it in our monitor anyway, so who cares? So I had this kind of department to myself in that instance. But yeah, I mean, I learned so much from that band, and both about... the business of being a musician and making a living and touring and that kind of thing. We were not a hugely successful band, but we sold 800 tickets once. That's pretty good.
That's legit.
We did a lot of shows over a 4-year period, and we put out 2 records, and we signed some record deals and that kind of thing. So I learned a lot from that. Musically, though, it's interesting. Whilst I don't want to disavow it, I learned a lot from it in many ways. When that band broke up, I sort of became a quote-unquote solo artist. And the sort of... it's difficult to put my finger on specifically, but in retrospect, one of the major differences was that I started thinking about songwriting as a holistic project rather than... There was a slight... In Million Dead, there was quite a sort of cut-and-shut kind of vibe to our... quote-unquote songwriting. It was just like, this is a cool riff, and this is another cool riff, and then we're going to put them... on top of each other, and then he's going to shout something over the top, and hey, there you go. And sometimes it worked, and they work as holistic songs, and sometimes it doesn't, or didn't, I should say. But it was thinking about the song as an entity unto itself was kind of the big change for me when that band broke up.
Was there a moment when that insight came to you all at once, or was that sort of like a slow realization, the idea that you had to look at a song as sort of a system in and of itself, and you had to look at the whole thing?
I'd say it was a slow process, and it had been bubbling away for some years. I mean, when I was, despite my childhood listening to kind of thrash and punk and all the rest of it, I had a sideline, and thanks to my older sister, of being into Counting Crows. And I always loved Counting Crows, and I feel very strongly that Adam, well, they're writing collectively, but Adam specifically was a great crash course in songwriting. God damn, you know. Not that I was thinking about it in those terms initially, but I can still play every song off their first three records with my eyes closed, you know. So, you know, that was kind of bubbling away. But I also, my taste in music kind of evolved a little while I was in Million Dead. I was in a hardcore band, touring with other hardcore bands, playing shows with other hardcore bands, and I couldn't then get in the van at the end of the day and listen to hardcore. I would have lost my mind. So, I started branching out a bit, and I sort of got into, I mean, initially just some kind of normal kind of alt country world. Josh Rouse, I don't know if you know Josh Rouse.
I do.
His first three or four records really, really turned my head. And then a friend of mine got me into Nebraska. Was a big thing, and my knowledge of Springsteen prior to that was pretty dismissive. He was the singing cheeseburger guy, and no thanks was kind of my vibe on it. And heard Nebraska and went, oh, hold on, this is something else. And then in particular, actually, the Johnny Cash American Recording series of albums was a big thing for me. And this is a simplification, but one of the major realizations for me and all that is that you could be intense without being loud, and that you could be heavy without necessarily having a shaved head and taking your shirt off and screaming at the front row and having a China symbol doing that on the quarters or whatever. And that was news to me. Because, yes. You know, I wasn't really familiar with that world. And I'd never really listened to Bob Dylan until my early 20s or any of that crew. And I got into Tom Petty for the first time in my life or whatever, because I didn't have this background growing up. So there was a big voyage of discovery through that kind of classic songwriter world.
I love the idea that you had to learn that being loud wasn't necessarily being intense and vice versa. I had to have a musician once explain to me, he's like, when you're playing something fast, it doesn't have to be loud. Like, loud and fast don't have to go together, and neither do slow and quiet. Like, something yeah. can be slow and fast or loud and quiet. And
Yeah.
A similar a galaxy brain moment for me.
Right, but exactly. And it sort of opened the door to kind of different modes of expression, really. You know, and of course, my sort of foundations still lie with a lot of that kind of punk rock music. And when I say punk rock, I use it in the broadest sense of the term, because a huge part of it for me was the kind of post-hardcore-y, it's now become a dirty word, but like emo thing of kind of Crank Records and bands like Sunny Day Real Estate and Mineral and that kind of thing. That was a big part of it for me as well. And there is a songwriting element hanging around in there too. But yeah, and then the other major contributing factor that's really worth a mention is it started as a social thing. I started hanging out at a different bar because my girlfriend at the time, it turns out, while I'd been on tour with Million Dead, had been generous with her affections to quite a lot of the people who hang out at the kind of punk rock bar where I used to hang out. And I came home and was sad about this. And a friend, a guy who at the time was a friend of a friend, sort of took pity on me, and he said, well, look, I run a bar in a different area of London. We don't sleep with each other's girlfriends. Come and hang out with us. So I did, and stumbled across this place. It was called Nambuka. It's still there, although different people now. But and it was this scene of people which had nothing to do with punk rock, but there was a real kind of energetic kind of DIY vibe going on. And there was a guy called Jay who, after the lock-in, when they closed the pub at night, they'd lock the doors, and he'd get out an acoustic guitar and play chords with three songs about us about his friends. I remember we had one weekend where everybody dropped acid and it was hilarious. And then the following weekend, he had a song about last weekend. And I was like, what? Because at the time, I would take 6 months to write a song. And it would have to have 19 different chord changes and blah, blah, blah. And it was so immediate, you know, and it felt, I mean, it felt kind of punk to me, but it was just so real and so visceral and real, you know. And there was a whole bunch of people around that scene who were kind of messing around with acoustic guitars, some of whom have gone on to do well. Jamie T was hanging around there. Laura Marling was part of that scene. A young lad called Marcus Mumford, who has gone on to do rather well, was on the fringes of it as well. So there was a lot of kind of people, but nobody knew who any of these people were at the time. It was very pure, you know, and there wasn't even much sense that it was a scene that was going to go on to greater things. It was just a bunch of kids messing around in a really unadorned way. And that was a real, real kind of learning experience for me, hanging out with those people and being part of it. And I started playing a couple of acoustic songs that I'd written that were about last weekend or whatever it might be. And when Million Dead broke up, I was gutted. And I went to that bar and I said to my friends, oh, my band just broke up. I'm really sad. And they all immediately said, well, just do the songs that you've done at the open mic night, do those ones. And I said, really? And they said, yeah, we like those ones. and that was, so it's all their fault, basically. That was a big transitional moment for me.
Getting better at your instrument is an essential part of being a songwriter. When you play better guitar, you write better songs. It's that simple. How do you do that, though? Sure, you could get lessons from the neighbor who majored in tonal dissonance at Swarthmore, but that'll cost you a pretty penny. Or else, you could pull up YouTube and pay nothing at all, but then you'll just end up sifting through videos of nerds unironically weeping as they play every Stone Gossard solo back-to-back for 2 straight hours. What's the sweet spot in between? Peghead Nation, the online home for American roots music. They feature curated video workshops with world-class instructors on guitar, mandolin, banjo, fiddle, upright bass, dobro, and ukulele. They have levels of instruction that meet the needs of both scrappy upstarts and grizzled veterans. And most importantly, all of it comes in at a low monthly subscription that actual strapped-for-cash songwriters can easily afford. To start taking classes yourself, head on over to pegheadnation.com to check out their 50 available courses and enter the promo code TWS, the initials of our show, TWS, to get your first month free. You can also send a gift subscription to the songwriter in your life or to the player in your band who needs a not-so-subtle hint about their playing prowess. Peghead Nation. When you play better guitar, you write better songs. It's that simple. It sounds like Frank found sobriety at just the right time in his journey. And talking to friends who have taken that same route themselves, there seems to be a sense that it's necessary not only to escape the deleterious effects of drink and drug, but also to reconnect with life on its own terms and notice, once again, the radical beauty of stone-cold reality. And there's a wonderful poem by the poet Tim Dlugos that explores this phenomenon. It's entitled, Ordinary Time. Which are the magic moments in ordinary time? All of them, for those who can see. That is what redemption means, I decide at the meeting. Then walk with David wearing his new Yale t-shirt and new long hair to 103. Leonard and Eileen come, too. Leonard wears a shark's tooth on a chain around his neck and long blonde hair. These days, he's the manager of Boots and Saddles and costumer for the gay cable network's dating game. One week, the announcer is a rhinestone cowboy, sequin shirt and black fur chaps, and the next, a leatherman, etc. Eileen's crew cut makes her face light up. Underneath our hairstyles, 23 years of sobriety, all told. The age of a girl who's not so young but not so very old, wrote Berryman. Who flew from his recovery with the force of a poet hitting bottom? It's not the way I choose to go out of this restaurant or day today, and I have a choice. Wanda the comedian comes over to our table. Call me Wicked Wanda, she smirks when we're introduced. Why is New York City awash in stand-up comics at the least funny point in its history? Still, some things stay the same. People wonder what the people in their buildings would think if the ones who were wondering became incredibly famous as Madonna. Debbie Harry lived in Eileen's building in the Village in the early 70s, and she was just the shy girl in the band upstairs. Poets read the writing of their friends and are happy when they like it thoroughly, when the work's that good and the crippling sense of competition stays away. Trips get planned. David, home to California, Eileen to New Mexico, Chris and I to France and Spain, on vectors which will spread out from a single point like ribs of an umbrella. Then, after the comfort of a wedge of blueberry peach pie and cup of decaf, sober friends thread separate ways home through the maze of blankets on the sidewalk, covered with the scraps of someone else's life. Mine consists of understanding that the magic isn't something that I make, but something that shines through the things I make and do and say, the way a brooch or scrap of fabric shines through the detritus to catch Leonard's eye and be of use for costumes. When I am fearless and thorough enough to give it room, all the room there is in ordinary time, which embraces all the people and events and hopes that choke the street tonight and still leaves room for everyone and everything and every other place, the undescribed and indescribable, more various and cacophonous than voice can tell or mind can conceive, and for the sky's vast depths from which they're all a speck of light. In retrospect, it all makes sense because, as you say, you know, you mentioned these other names that were part of that scene, yourself, and there's sort of like, at this point, there's a bit of a well-trod path between being in maybe a heavier band and then kind of taking it a singer-songwriter route. That was kind of uncharted territory, though, about 15 years ago. So what did that feel like to leave that band and go out in that way? Did it feel like you were doing something kind of reckless or crazy or stupid or what?
It's funny. At the time, all my friends thought I was insane, and I thought I had a plan. And now I look back at it, and I think I must have been insane, and all my friends think I must have had a plan. You know, it's flipped. I'm proud of it in a way, in the sense that there's a part of me that is quite surprised by how pure my decision-making was at that point in time. It was not. If I'd joined another punk band, I probably could have kept selling 800 tickets for shows and all the rest of it. But my first solo show after Me and Deb broke up, I had two people there who were both on the guest list. And you know what I mean? And like, it was back right down to zero. And I just sort of had this kind of drive and purity to it. I felt like I had something to say, and I felt like I had a new musical landscape to explore. And I did it because I believed in it. And I'm quite proud of me in my early 20s in a funny way, because it wasn't the popular or the cool or the established route. And nobody else thought it was going to go anywhere. And I'm not even sure if I thought it was going to go anywhere, but I felt like I needed to do it, you know. I'm proud of that.
Where do you think that character trait of yours stems from, to want to do something? You mentioned, you kind of described it as a decision-making process that was very pure, and you were going after something oh, you might call it truth and beauty and going after that, you know, first and foremost. So where do you think that's an odd, it's an odd part of a character to have. I think all of us, you know, stray away from that. Where do you think that part of your character comes from?
I mean, that's a fine question, and I might be the wrong person to ask. I mean, my mom is quite sort of practical and get on with it kind of thing. I do think that part of it links back to what we touched on earlier, that my process of getting into music was quite solitary. Not completely. But it wasn't at the beginning. I was just buying records and listening to them on my own in my headphones and discovering this whole world that I knew nothing about. And this before the internet as well. So, you know, I was pretty kind of mystical in some ways. And so it's just kind of like, from an early age, I was quite used to kind of like thinking about music and making decisions about music in an entirely solitary way, you know, or at least not needing external validation for my creative decisions, you know. I mean, in a funny way, one could argue that, like, it's fortunate that it worked out and therefore we're having this conversation, because there is, of course, an alternative universe in which it didn't, and then we're talking about that ridiculous idea I had of doing an acoustic record after being in a punk band that went nowhere, or whatever. So who knows? But it's a facet of my character. It's also a facet of my sister's characters, so there's something in the family.
It's funny, I don't know if you've ever read about this before, but throughout history, when people are coming to inventions, sometimes in different places in the world, not even knowing that the other is working on it, people are in kind of parallel step working towards a similar invention. Sure. And as you were trotting that path, there was a similar path being trod across the pond here in the United States by a lot of the people who would be part of what we would call the revival tour, with Chuck Reagan and Dave Haas and Jim Ward. And then you end up becoming a part of that crew and hitting the road with those guys. How did that musical friendship affect your creative life?
Oh, enormously so. And it remains a point of pride for me that I'm the token English guy from the revival crew. yeah, that was a beautiful thing, actually. So I had a poster of Chuck on my wall when I was younger from his Hot Water Music days. And when I say poster, it wasn't really a poster. It was an advert from the back page of a zine or something that had just a poster of Chuck kind of going, like at Common Ground in Gainesville or something. And I had it stuck up on my wall. And I'm still not 100% sure how, but Chuck became aware of what I was doing and offered me 4 shows on the revival tour, the first one in 2008. And I was blown away by it, because at the time I was doing a few shows in America, but it was incredibly hand-to-mouth DIY touring with some friends of mine in vans, or I did a coffee shop tour in a car with a friend of mine and no one came. And we drove like 8,000 miles or something and played to like 8 people. So, you know, I'd been sort of trying to begin slogging away at the American idea without a huge amount of success. And at the end of a very long and grueling tour, I got offered these 4 shows. And it wasn't just Chuck, you know, Avail remained one of my all-time favorite bands. And Tim Barry was on the shows. And it was like, holy cow. And Ben from Lucero as well, and I felt very honored. That was the bill. It was me, Chuck, Ben, and Tim, and that was crazy to me. And that first night was the first time, first of all, I'd ever played to like certainly triple figures in the States, but maybe even double figures of audience members. It was in Asbury Park. But what I did went over super well with the audience, and I was sort of aware that Chuck was doing solo stuff, and I was aware that Tim was doing solo stuff. And so I know what you mean about that kind of convergence idea, and there were some flags in the ground. I think that Against Me's early stuff was a big part of that, that kind of acoustic punk thing on Crime Is Forgiven By. I think that some of the things that Social D had done in terms of bringing Johnny Cash into punk rock was an early precursor of that as well. I have a bit of a theory as well that there was an inevitable point in the evolution as punk as a concept, when something that starts in the late 70s with no future gets to a point of having several generations involved in the same thing. It's going to involve a kind of philosophical recalibration on some level. It sort of has to, you know. Johnny Rotten's got grandkids now, you know what I mean? Like, what? So, you know, some sort of like philosophical soul searching was within punk as a concept, I think, was sort of inevitable at some point, and this is one of the ways that that's kind of panned out. But yeah, it was. It felt, when I came to those revival shows, I felt like I found my people, definitely. I remember very much feeling so inspired by that tour as a writer. You know, because again, there was an immediacy to it. The way that the tool worked, you know, you would just in conversation during the day, someone would suggest a song, whether it was one of yours or a cover or whatever, and everyone would learn the chords and we'd play it that night, and people would figure out harmonies. And, you know, it was so, again, very, very kind of immediate. And it made me want to write more songs that would sort of fit that format. I wrote a song called The Road that was very much inspired by being around the revival tour. It was a huge thing for me. And like, I my music has, and my songwriting has gone on to other places since, but I am actually kind of actively thinking about kind of getting back to that raw acoustic thing at the moment anyway.
It's so interesting that you mentioned, you know, finding your people, both with the guys on stage, the guys and gals on stage, but also with an audience. One thing that I don't think I understood before playing music, I thought, well, if you can get on an opening tour and play for any group, 1,000 people, that's a good thing. And now, of course, I know it's better to play for 50 people who are really into what you do than 2,000 people that have no clue. And so... that is such a formative part of being a musician. I actually interviewed, you mentioned earlier, Ian MacKay on this podcast, and I was asking him, I was like, you know, what's up with your creativity these days? Are you writing? And he said, well, I have a hard time writing because I used to know who I was writing for, and now I don't know who I'm writing for. And so it sounds like you found a place. It's like, that's a very inspiring thing to come to a club and play for a group of people who immediately... They get what you're putting out there.
Sure. So I know Ian a little, and he's an absolute diamond, and of course he's Ian fucking MacKay, so you know, yeah, all the hats off. So I'm very reticent to do what I'm about to do, which is to disagree. Yes, to a degree. I feel very strongly like my only audience as a writer is my own best judgment. Nothing else. I couldn't give a fuck about anything else. In fact, I think it's really, really important that I don't. You know, when I write a song, when I wrote the first songs that I wrote as a solo artist or even in a band, I sat in a room with a guitar and I made a noise that I thought sounded cool, and that's it. And to me, I don't want to be writing for a specific audience. I don't think as an artist you get to choose your audience. People show up. Deal with it. Do you know what I mean? Like, and of course, it's fantastic if you find a scene, you find a group of people who love what you do. But you know, and of course it's fantastic if you make music and people connect with it. If anyone connects with it, that's great. It feels good. It pays the bills, whatever else it might be. But like, the only moments of regret I have in my career as a musician and are the moments when I've strayed close to writing songs for a different audience other than my own best judgment. I'm not sure that I've ever actually fully like attempted to please the radio plugger or the A&R guy or the girlfriend or whatever it might be, but you know, there's been moments when that's kind of bled in a little bit to my decision making process, and those are the moments I regret. And like, I feel it's really important that my audience that I write for is, I don't want to say it's not quite myself, but it's like, it's just my own taste in music. You know, is this cool? Do I like this? Does it feel good to me? And that's it, you know, and I don't ever want to think about anything else when I write.
Well, it sounds like you're in the same place that you were, you know, 15 years ago when you, you know, with that idea of I want to do something true, I want to do something beautiful, and that's where we're going. You've spent a lot of time on the road over the years. There's a certain lifestyle that goes along with being on the road. I've been a part of it myself, full disclosure. You had to extricate yourself from that lifestyle, and in fact, there's a new song on your new record. I want to talk about the new record in general. It's called Untainted Love, and it begins with what is apparently a Johnny Cash quote that I'd never heard before, where he told Bono, "I sure do miss them drugs," which is brilliant. What made you decide to make that change in lifestyle, and how has that affected both your creativity and then also your approach to being on the road and touring and bringing the music to people?
Well, actually, the first thing to say for me is that like my substance abuse issues and touring were for the longest time sort of two separate channels of my life. Like, really? I would get fucked up when I got home. I've never really been very good at playing when I'm messed up. I mean, I'll have a couple of drinks, but anything stronger than that, and I can't really play, and I know I can't really play. And the thing is, for a longer period of time, for the longest period of time, my substance abuse issues were under control because I was on tour so much that I would come home for like 4 days, get fucked up, and then go on tour again. And it was okay, and it was under control. And there was a moment in my career when the gaps between tours started becoming a bit longer for various reasons, one of which that I was kind of doing quite well and could afford to take more time off the road and all the rest. And that's when the kind of boundaries start and my control of the situation started to fall apart. And there were some times when substance abuse then came onto the road and I played some of the worst shows of my life, and I'm really fucking ashamed of that. But so, you know, there's a wonderful line, the Hold Steady, one of my all-time favorite bands, and Craig is a friend but also an incredible writer, and there's a line in one of their songs where he says it started recreational and it ended kind of medical, and that killed me the first time I heard him say that, because my Christ, is that true for me. There was one day it was partying, and then suddenly it was 5 years later and it wasn't partying by any conceivable measure, you know, and it felt like work and it felt like medication and it felt like, yeah, it was bad news, essentially. And I'm pleased, after a lot of effort, to currently have that in my rearview mirror. It is an ongoing thing. It will always be an ongoing thing. That's the nature of addiction. But, like, I'm not sure I ever bought the... I never wrote Fucked Up. And I'm not sure I really buy the idea that anyone's ever written anything good when they're wasted. Like, I mean, you know, there are exceptions to this if you want to get into the weeds of which type of drugs we're talking about. But generally speaking, I'm not convinced that oblivion does much for creativity, actually. I don't think that that's certainly my experience of it is that that's not really true. And also, I mean, a huge thing I mentioned earlier, but Nick Cave's been a huge, kind of guiding light for me in a way. And one of the things about Nick Cave is he has these two very distinct phases of his career. He has when he was messed up and when he was clean. And I personally think he became an infinitely better songwriter when he got clean. Like, Abattoir Blues is my favorite record he ever did by miles. And that was his first clean record. And it's just startlingly brilliant. And so, you know, And also, talking about lifestyle on the road, another thing that's been really good for me in recent years, we've done a bunch of touring with Jason Isbell, who I'm sure you know, and who is a phenomenal songwriter and a lovely human, but also quite famously is sober. And we did some touring with him in the States where he had his daughter and his wife along with him, and it wasn't like a dry backstage, you know, if you wanted a glass of wine, you'd have a glass of wine, but like no one was doing tequila shots, you know what I mean? And it was this really kind of like stable and healthy approach to being on the road, and it was quite revelatory for me to experience that. It was like, oh shit, this works. In fact, hold on, whisper it, this is better, like, because we play better shows and I don't feel like shit 23 hours a day, and do you know what I mean, and I can sing better, and so on and so on and so on. So definitely. And then the final thing, sorry, this is a long answer to a short question, the final thing is that, like, I've realized, you know, I'm 40 years old now, and it's a marathon and not a sprint, and I would like to do this for the rest of my life. Now, there's a couple of contributory factors to whether or not that's possible, one of which is whether or not anyone cares enough for me to keep doing this for a long time. Right. But it's also, you know, you can do things in your 20s you can't do in your 30s, let alone your 40s, physically speaking. There are tour schedules I look back on from my 20s when we would do, like, 24 shows in a row without a day off. Like, I couldn't do that now. Like, are you kidding? If we do like four in a row, I'm like half dead. So, you know, it's these things change, but like I'm trying to find ways of sustaining this in the longer term because I love it and it's what I want to do.
It's funny. I think you're totally right that no one ever actually, well, I shouldn't say no one, but that most people don't create from a state of oblivion, being totally messed up. But I do think it becomes a part of people's narrative about how they create it.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. In a way that I think is really toxic, actually. Yeah. You know, I think Kurt Cobain's one of the greatest songwriters of the 20th century, and I think it has fuck all to do with his heroin addiction. And I think that the two things should be separated, you know, and I am going to say this, and it's going to get me in trouble. I absolutely loathe the Doors. I can't stand the Doors. And one of the reasons is I think that Jim Morrison was somebody who wrote while he was tripping. And boy, can you tell, because it's boring and mundane and just... And now watch the hate roll in. I'm sorry if you like the Doors, good for you, enjoy the music and all the rest of it, but it's to me, that's the sound, that's what writing when you're messed up sounds like to
well,
me, and it's not to my taste.
I think you're going to be canceled for admitting that you don't like,
yeah, 17 minute organ jams,
you know. Well, listen, man, this has been so fascinating talking to you about your years doing this and your perspective on all things creative, and I really appreciate you taking the time to do the show. Thank you so much.
It is a great pleasure, and like I was trying to explain this to a friend of mine the other day, like, you know, there's a kind of like memes on the internet of like you ask a guy what he's thinking about and it's usually like tractors or like steak knives or something. Like, yeah. When my wife asks me what I'm thinking about, 99% of the time it's songwriting. That is my major obsession in life. And like, she's, what are you thinking about? And it's like, is there anything that rhymes with the word heretofore? Or is that pretentious? And she's just like, oh my God. And so I spend a lot of time thinking about this stuff, and it's lovely to really dive into it. So thank you for having me.
Thank you. We'll see you down the line, man. Peace.
All the best.
This week's show is brought to you by Bandzoogle. Built by musicians and for musicians, Bandzoogle is an all-in-one platform to build a beautiful website for your music. Use promo code TWS, the initials of our podcast, TWS, to get 15% off the first year of any subscription. Frank Turner's latest album is entitled FTHC. That's initialism for Frank Turner Hardcore. It's available everywhere music is sold or streamed. If before we meet again you sit down to write, please remember, an expensive drug habit is not a song, a compelling Instagram account is not a song, and most importantly, reverb is not a song. So let all that take care of itself, and for you, just keep your eye on the song.